Hi, I'm Brian.
And I'm Sharon.
I had a 40-year porn addiction.
Porn was an unwelcome guest for 32 years of our marriage.
I found hope and freedom when I attended a Gateway to Freedom weekend.
And I found hope and the courage to begin my healing journey while attending Wives Care.
Don't be like us and allow porn to wreak havoc in your lives.
Reach out to Be Broken today.
To learn more about Gateway to Freedom, 3-day intensive for men, and Wives Care online groups, visit BeBroken.org or call 210-822-8201. That's BeBroken.org or 210-822-8201. Good day, friends. Jonathan Darty here with another edition of the PSR Podcast. You know, we're a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries, and we exist to help individuals and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. In today's episode, I'm so thrilled to welcome Dr. Steve Call, a clinical psychologist and co-author with Dr. Dan Allender of The Deep-Rooted Marriage, Cultivating Intimacy, Healing, and Delight. We dive into the book's themes, focusing on how past traumas influence present marital conflicts and how to grow an emotional understanding and intimacy. Dr. Call shares his personal marriage journey, emphasizing the importance of awareness and curiosity in relationships. We then discuss some practical steps for couples to cultivate awareness, the role of play in healing, and strategies for managing triggers. Dr. Call offers hope and resources for couples to nourish their relationships. To learn more about Dr. Call's resources, including a marriage intensive, and to get the book, visit thereconnectinstitute.com. For additional resources, visit BeBroken.org or check out all the links that we're going to put in today's show notes. And friends, as always, we're going to invite you to rate and review the podcast after listening to help others find it. Now let's get into today's conversation with Steve about the deep-rooted marriage. Well, all right, Dr. Steve Call, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Jonathan. It's really good to be with you. Thanks for the time together.
I was super excited when your literary agent reached out to me about the potential of having you on as a guest, because you have recently co-written a book with Dr. Dan Allender that's entitled The Deep-Rooted Marriage, Cultivating Intimacy, Healing, and Delight. And we're going to talk about that. That's going to be kind of the main emphasis of our conversation. But first of all, I'd love for our listeners and viewers just to get to know you a little bit. So can you share a little bit of just your own story and how you got into the work that you're doing?
Sure, you bet. Most of my work, I would say, is influenced by my marriage. So Lisa and I have been married almost 38 years. We met in college and got married right out of college. It's been a wonderful journey, difficult journey at times. I began my work in a church setting. I loved working with college students and found that to be really life-giving. And so I went back to school for a number of years, did my doctorate in clinical psychology at Seattle Pacific University a few decades ago. And so since then, my work is primarily focused on couples. We do, individuals, but also working with couples primarily. We also offer what I do, I find really enriching, is I work a lot in intensive formats with couples as well. Mm. And it has been a really, really good journey. Difficult, yes, at times, but I love my work. Can be emotionally taxing, but I've really appreciated the privilege to come alongside couples over the last few decades.
That's great. Let me ask you real quick about the intensives. What are some of the primary reasons that couples are looking for that kind of format of counseling?
I have found it to be maybe more of a helpful starting place for many couples. Sometimes it's difficult for them to get into the what we call the story work, the actual family of origin story history, and short increments of time. And so it encourages and allows couples to really dive into their story, particularly their family of origin story. Yes, their marriage story, but for a lot of couples, what is difficult to enter into is what we would just call their trauma story. Particular trauma history narrative in their story that hasn't really been addressed, and so sometimes that intensive format creates a longer space, if you will, a longer time to actually engage some of what has not been named or what has not been revealed.
Yeah, I love that. We do 3-day intensives for men who are dealing with unwanted sexual behaviors. And I think I'm going to steal how you just described that, because that's exactly what we do. When you can have a longer period of uninterrupted time to get that story work out, it makes a huge difference. We see that happen all the time in those weekends.
It does. I mean, it just creates a foundation that we can build upon. I just really like the depth of the foundation that we're working from if we start with that.
So tell us a little bit about how you and Dr. Allender, first of all, how you maybe know each other and how you got to working on this book together.
Sure. So Dan and I have been teaching at the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology for over 20 years. So he was one of the founders. I came in about a year after it started. And we are, I mean, I would just say comrades. Like we love to play together. We love to work together and we love to write together. And one of the things that we love to do is fish. We fly fish over in Montana often. And so this book came from our multiple trips to Montana, meaning the way which we wanted, what we wanted to write about, maybe the themes we wanted to address. We taught a class at the Seattle School for years called Marriage and Family. And so some of the material that we would teach our graduate students is some of also what we wanted to write about. And so it came over the course of the last 10 years, just dreaming, you know, this mindfulness of what we would want to create together. We also wanted our wives to be a part of it as well. So Dan and his wife, Becky, Lisa and myself, we do these 3-day intensives. And that's also part of what led to some of what we wrote, is being able to integrate some of what we teach and some of what we work with couples in. So it was really, really a good, lovely process to be able to do that with him.
That's so good. So why don't you share with us a little bit of just kind of an overview of what the book is about and like who is it really for? Like what couple is it really for? And then I've got some specific questions where we can maybe start drilling down into some certain areas of it.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, playfully, I'd say for all couples, whether they're, you know, married one day or married 50 years, it really, I think, is meant to be a broad stroke, but also really with the intent for many couples that may not be aware of how their past is being reflected or remembered or reenacted in the present. That is a primary theme in what we've written, is we want to help our readers, our listeners, to be aware of how their past is being remembered, felt, experienced in the present. Much of my conflict, much of my tension in my marriage with Lisa is connected to past. And that's not always true, but I think it's more true than we're able at times to be aware of, but willing to be aware of. And so it's also meant to be a source of hope. I mean, marriage is a difficult journey. It's glorious at times, it's wonderful at times, and it's really difficult at times. And so we want it to be a beacon of hope, of what it can be, look like. It's not as if Dan and Becky and Steve and Lisa have it all together. That's not ever what we want to reflect and what we write. We're on the journey together. And I think that's part of our hope, is that people would have some source of, oh, this is what it could be. Meaning moments in our marriage could be like this. Not fully, not always, but I think a way to engage the past that honors what they're experiencing in the present with the hope of what it could be in the future.
Yeah, I really want to drill down into that more, because I think even what you're sharing there is something that is a felt experience by a lot of couples.
Yeah.
But it's probably not reached a cognition state. In other words, they're not consciously aware of what's going on in terms of the connection between past and what's happening now. I think a lot of couples, I know that when I was getting married, over 29 years ago, my thought was, especially considering that I was bringing a secret sexual addiction into my marriage, I had this idea of marriage is a demarcation of everything's moving forward. The past is going to be sort of almost erased, and now I'm going to have a new life with this person. So help us go deeper into that realization of what couples need to understand about that connection between past and maybe present conflict and difficulties in their marriage.
Yeah, Jonathan, I really appreciate that, because what you've shared about your story, because I think for many of us, that's how we begin marriage. Almost with the assumption that the past is the past. I'm done with that. I'm turning the page. It no longer is part of the present. And I think it's just really difficult at times to honor how the past is part of the present. I mean, it comes up for Lisa and I often. Can I say every day? Maybe close to it. The other day, well, this is during Christmas season, and Lisa wanted, we had our family over and she wanted to have a family picture, and which is, of course, like a really beautiful desire. And she's sitting next to me while somebody's taking the picture, and she just gently elbows me in the gut and says, "Remember not to chew." Okay. It's right. Like, it's really, it's of course, like it's a kind, in a way, it's a kind request. She wants a good picture. Well, in my story, what I'll say is there was an embedded preoccupation with performance. Look right, do right, perform, literally. That's your way of being known. That's your way of being accepted. That's your way of being seen. And so something got what we call just triggered for me. When we have a physiological reaction to the present, something is being remembered. And again, I want to be really careful with, that's not always true, but more true than we want it to be. So I was irritated. I was bothered. I was maybe even hurt. I was a little disappointed. A lot of emotion just with that one sentence. And so I got up from the table after the picture. I went into my office. I was a little hurt. I was a little frustrated. Now that is part of my story, meaning that's something in the present being activated, reflected, remembered from the past. And I would say that's more often true than, again, we want it to be true. So part of it is our hope is really cultivating awareness. When I have, you have, we have some kind of reactivity in the moment, can we be curious to what that might be connected to? We're not always aware in the moment. That's why it's helpful when our spouse, our partner is curious with us. Hey, what happened for you? What was going on? Do you want to share? Do you want to connect a little bit about it? And so it's this cult, what we like, again, we love that word cultivate. That's why we use that word often in what we write, because it is meant to cultivate over time. We're cultivating awareness. We're becoming more aware of, oh, that actually might be connected to something other than what just happened between us.
Now, I love what you're saying there, especially one word I want to kind of hone in on is that word curiosity, because I think especially for the men out there, because, you know, we've in our ministry, we're dealing with men all the time that have all kinds of sexual brokenness issues. And so there's a lot of emotional disconnection, you know, even a lot of emotional stuntedness in terms of growth. So even that idea of curiosity can be very foreign and maybe new to a husband out there that is going, what does that even look like, Steve? What do you mean? What are you talking about being curious? If my wife says something to me and I'm offended, why on earth am I going to want to be curious? How do I start to switch, like shift that from being offended to then trying to have a curious disposition to those things that rise up in me or rise up in her?
I love that you've shared that, because for many of us, curiosity was not what was modeled in our own story. There wasn't maybe an attuned caregiver or somebody that was actually facing toward us with kindness. I think curiosity is a posture of kindness, whether that's to ourselves or to our partner or to our spouse. I almost want to say it's a muscle that we develop over time. It's not something we just flip the switch. It's not something we say, oh, I'm just going to be curious. But are we willing to be curious? I think that's more of the issue. It's much easier for me to be upset with Lisa and blame her for how I feel than it is to be curious about what that was connected to for me. That's a learned pattern for most of us in marriage. It's much easier to be upset at our partner, at our spouse, than it is to be curious. So I think it takes a little bit of integrity, honestly, a little bit of intentionality. We love the phrase intentional curiosity. It's not something that happens naturally to us or for us. So I think there's this intentionality. We get on the bike, we don't know how to ride, but we're just intentional with the movement of it. I like that imagery. I think that's a helpful imagery of, can I be willing to be curious? What does it take for me? And sometimes it takes the other to actually help us. That's the bind with curiosity. It's not like I'm going into my office saying, wow, I wonder what just happened for me. That's not always the natural response. Sometimes it helps the other, helps us when the other is curious with us. Hey, do you want to check in? Something seemed to happen for you. It's not out of blame. It's not out of accusation, but it's out of a desire to advocate for what we might have been experiencing.
Yeah. I like what you're saying there. It does require a lot of humility in order to engage that. Because sometimes, you know, we want to take that offense. We want to be in control. What are some of the common, you know, obviously your book, like you said, you want it to have this universal appeal to couples and yet also be able to speak to very specific situations. So what are some of the common narratives that can lead to marital conflict or just discord in a relationship?
I would say for most of us and most couples, there may be three or four different experiences or categories that contribute to maybe this sense of disconnection. Maybe there's a sense of not feeling maybe what we used to feel. I think often there's a sense of loneliness that, you know, thematically that's occurring for one or both of the partners. Sometimes there's just this feeling stuck. Sometimes there's this sense of contempt, which is just this kind of accusation, kind of blame, it's this tension. Most of the struggles are often connected to what we would just call unaddressed trauma. Parts of our story that may not have been revealed, named, shared, spoken, tended to with kindness. I think for many couples, that's often what I see in our work, but also what we hope for readers and listeners is that phrase, unaddressed trauma, might feel like foreign language. It might feel like, what? I haven't heard that before. When we talk about trauma, we don't necessarily talk about it as capital T trauma. More often than not, for many, many of us, it's this lowercase T for trauma. Maybe misattunement from the caregiver, maybe the sense of a emotional neglect or experiences that were formed and shaped in our early years that tend to play a part in how we engage in our marriage. And so it's not ever with the intent to fault or blame. It's more of just like, can we be aware of how that is being played out, particularly between the two of you?
Mm-hmm. You know, as you were saying that, one of the things that also popped into my head, it might be even a category a little bit lower than that little T trauma, is I'd heard somebody say that for the average American, we are going to face roughly 20 disappointments every day. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how does that start to compound and build up, not only personally, but also what kind of effect that does that then have on a marriage? Can you speak a little bit to the need for just growing in awareness overall, emotionally, relationally, just maybe even spiritually? What does growing in awareness look like? And that kind of ties in a little bit with that curiosity aspect. But how often do you see, even in your counseling, a real lack of awareness when it comes to these issues in a marriage?
Mm-hmm. You know, that would be a word if anybody were to say, what's one word? And I'll come back to it maybe toward the end. But I think that is the word that I would hope for most of us, is that word awareness. That literally was one of the foundational principles of what we wanted to write, is the sense of cultivating awareness, inviting awareness. Again, what is so hard at times is it takes a lot of integrity and humility, I think, to actually choose to be aware, to ask myself that question, to ask ourselves that question, what is that about? What is that connected to? Rather than what's wrong with me? What's wrong with you? Often those 20 disappointments, often those are used as what we would just call ammunition to use against the other and or to use it myself. I think for many men, for most of us, there's a sense of futility relationally often that occurs. I don't know how to do this. Maybe it wasn't modeled for me. Maybe I don't quite know how to relate well to my partner, to my spouse. So I think awareness really is with the intent to grow in humility, but also in integrity to say, what is happening for me? Can I somehow attribute to what I might be experiencing to something other than the fault of my spouse? I think that's often a common dynamic, both what we write about and teach and talk about, is that we often make our spouse partner pay for the harm that we've endured. And I think that sometimes what is true is we're not aware that that's the pattern that's at play. So that to me, if you were to say one word, if we only had one word in our vocabulary about the hope of marriage or the hope of what we're writing and reading about and working in marriage, it's really awareness.
Wow. So if that is the big, kind of the big picture, yeah. Can you give us, like, especially for those of us who may go, if that seems like such a big concept, it's so overwhelming. Can you give like a simple definition? And then how do you start to grow in, like, what are some practical ways to become more aware?
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the question of either myself or the other. I love the question of what just happened and or what happened. Or what's happening, meaning as close to real time as possible, but not always possible. can we actually ask ourselves or ask the other or have some the safe other ask us that question? What just happened for you? You seem really bothered. You seem really hurt. You seem really disappointed. Do you want to check in about it? That is how we cultivate awareness. It's intentional. It's also asking that question. It's one of the most helpful questions we ask in conflict, actually. When we're in conflict, can we actually hit the what we call the pause button? Pause button of, hey, can we pause for a moment? What's happening? What just happened for you? Or what just happened for me? I think that's part of where awareness can grow. Yes, we go back to the word intentional. There's a strategy to it. Sometimes I like strategy. I used to coach high school boys basketball. I love strategy. I think it can be really helpful in moments. But when we're overwhelmed, when we're what we call flooded emotionally, it's hard. It's difficult to pause and have awareness. That's why I think we need the other sometimes in those moments. It's difficult to self-regulate on our own.
Yeah, it's kind of like when makes me think of the Mike Tyson quote says, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah, you know? And they just react. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So I guess a little bit of what you're saying is if awareness is the big picture, how can we start to get that more down into our bones so that's more of how we react when we are punched in the face rather than it's real mechanical or I've got to really think through this. I mean, we all have to start somewhere. I love the fact that you talked about coaching, you know, basketball. It's like, if you get a brand new guy on the court that's never picked up a basketball before, you're not going to advanced drills or advanced plays. It's like, okay, this is a basketball, right? He's got to learn how to hold it and dribble it and pass it. And there's a lot of basics in order to understand that.
There are. I just started last year, 2 years ago, actually, I started playing pickleball. And I love that game. But how do I develop and grow in it is literally I practice. I know that can't go without saying, but it's also almost assumed. Like, how do we become more aware? We practice it. And that it's not that simple. I think that's what's hard about it is it's simple in the concept, but it's not simple in the practicality of it. Sometimes it takes me a day or two to come back to what I experienced with Lisa. Sometimes it takes me a day or two to come back to what I experienced with one of my children. There's a window of time that occurs. And the hope is that window of time is less over our life together. So that, I think that's the important piece is will we be willing to return? So to return to what got activated, what was remembered, what was felt, what did you experience? That's the key is the intentional return to what we might experience, whether that was an hour ago, a day ago, a week ago. That window of time is a really important part of the process.
And you know what I'm hearing you say, and maybe you know I'm asking for some free counsel right here, Steve. Is you know it almost makes me think like if I'm going to develop in the same way that you would develop a discipline in learning a sport or learning how to grow a skill in a sport, what would it look like if let's say once every hour or two in the day I said I'm going to discipline myself towards awareness. So I'm going to stop every hour and take 2 minutes and go, what's going on? What happened? What is, you know, because I think sometimes, especially in our culture that is so fast paced and it's always forward moving, even in marriages, I see this all the time, even as my kids are growing up and getting married and all this. And I'm going, the pace of life, how can you cultivate a really deep, intimate relationship when everything is so fast? So this idea of slowing down, the fact that it takes time is really important. I wanted to ask you a question, you know, because I'm always curious about this for anybody that writes a book. What was your favorite part of the content that you were writing? Like, what was the favorite part of the book? And I know that, you know, you're supposed to say you love it all, right? But there's got to be something that you go, this was my, like that piece of content or that insight, that was my favorite part of the book.
I appreciate you asking that. Honestly, it was a really hard process for me personally because of what I shared in some of the stories around my own family of origin. Mm-hmm. That part, there's almost like this, not writer's remorse. It's not like that. Like I want to take it back, but there are parts of what I shared that I at times I'm like, I can't believe people get to have access to that part of my story. Mm-hmm. That's one part of the battle. But if you were to say the favorite part, I think it's the last chapter that I wrote, and it's really the material around play. The idea that play is a healing balm, rituals of connection. When you were talking about the mindfulness of how we pause, how we develop rituals of play, what does that look like to connect? relationally, intentionally throughout our week together. That has been foundational for Lisa and I, but also for couples that I work with. I just think we cannot bear the heartache and difficulty of this world without some intentionality with play. Whatever play means to listeners and to readers, it really is with the idea of it play is the expression of you are chosen and we are chosen. I just think it has this healing balm quality to it. So that to me was my favorite part. Like, I love talking, teaching, celebrating how play can be that level of intimacy within our marriage that we desire.
That's so good. And now we're going to have a lot of couples that are listening to this that, because of the work that we do and that they've experienced probably some kind of sexual brokenness in their relationship and having to work through the restoration and the challenges of forgiveness and rebuilding trust and all of that, they might immediately hear you talking about play and then they go, "Ooh, that's an impossibility. There's no way. Yeah. I mean, we can't even imagine what that would look like." Right. And there's an appropriate seriousness that comes around the recovery of a marriage that's been damaged and hurt by sexual betrayal. But what kind of message of hope would you give that doesn't have to be the killer of all play, of all delight, of all joy in a marriage, even when there's been that deep pain?
Mm. You know, that's part of why we actually address play toward the end of the writing, because of the process it takes us potentially to move toward the freedom of play. That yes, there is shame connected to betrayal and harm within a marriage, outside of a marriage as well. And part of the recovery process, if you will, is how we develop these rituals that in a way that doesn't allow shame to have this firm grip that it wants on our story and our life together. So it's actually, I would sometimes think about play as an antibiotic to shame, that sometimes mm-hmm. play is with the intent to loosen the grip of shame. And so I get it. Like, there are a lot of couples, yes, when we start talking about play, but it is meant to reveal the goodness of how we are created, because play is innate. So yes, there is a process, yet what you've named around working through the harm, working through the betrayal. But if that's the end of the story, that's a really difficult outcome. So meaning that when shame has this grip on us, it's difficult to allow freedom of play to occur. And yet it is often the antidote of what we're craving.
Now, we know that when a couple is trying to repair and restore from a lot of this brokenness, that there's a lot of triggering that can go on, right? Yes. There's a lot of feelings. So what are some ways that their safety can be created when those triggers fire off?
I love that you asked that, because that's often what we work with in that process of recovery, is when both are triggered, when both are reacting, when both are somehow reminded of the harm. Often for many couples, the struggle is when shame invites shame, meaning when one feels shame, it tends to invite somehow promote shame for the other. And those are difficult moments. So part of the process, again, as we've talked about, is the awareness of what I like to use the phrase is internal scripts. What am I saying to me about me? What's the language? What am I thinking, believing about myself that's maybe informing or impacting this moment? I honestly don't know of any other greater strategy than that word pause. Can we pause for a moment? When we're aware that we're not headed in a good direction, it takes all the courage in the world to actually say, "Hey, can we pause for a moment? I'm not sure this is headed in a good direction." We can pause as long as what we call this reassurance of return. At some point, can we re-engage? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's an hour later, maybe that's tomorrow morning. But there is some time frame. It's very difficult for the one that's being asked to pause to not have some reassurance to return. That's a really important part of the process. So recovery can occur when we're aware of what's happening in our body, when not that we're asking permission, but we're inviting good care. I think it's kind for me, kind for you, kind for us to actually ask the other, "Hey, would you be all right if we pause here? I'm feeling a little overwhelmed. I'm not so sure this is going to go in a good direction. Would it be okay if we came back to this a little bit later?" That, I mean, honestly, that's about as good as it gets in those moments.
And then so what would be helpful for both parties in that pause to be working on, thinking about, kind of preparing for in terms of the re-engagement?
Good. When we are triggered, or when we're having a reactivity, or what we call, formally we can call it, when we're dysregulated, movement is the most helpful part of recovery. Some form of movement. It can be a walk around the house. It can be a walk around outside. It can be a sit up or two. It can be a sit up and sit down. Just some form of movement that literally metabolizes our emotional response. So that, I love that image. It doesn't take 20 minutes. It can take 2 minutes. So a helpful strategy is movement. I think another helpful strategy is what we've invited a lot of people to do is reflection. Just that question. Sometimes it's handwritten. Sometimes it's, I write a note on my phone. Sometimes it's a, you know, I can say it out loud on my phone and have it recorded. Something that just says, what just happened for me? The mindfulness of what's happening in our body is a really helpful part of the recovery process. So how we address it, how we return to it is one thing. But I think what you just asked is so helpful of, how can I care well for myself? What does that look like? For some, it's a walk. Some, it's a warm blanket. Some it's a candle. Some, it's a bath. Some, it's movement. For me, often, I go to my golden retriever, Otis. Like, mm-hmm. Otis and I hang out for a few minutes. I mean, what we almost refer to as grounding. I go to Otis. There's comfort. Like, I breathe. My heart rate goes down. Okay, I can return to this.
Well, I'm sure Otis is a great listener, too. So,
That's the beauty about golden retrievers. They just have this level of empathy that is through the roof.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Steve, this has been a phenomenal conversation. What would be kind of the message that you would want to send to the couples that are out there, no matter where they are kind of in their relationship, whether they're in a real place of deep hurting or if they're kind of on the way to growing, or maybe they're thriving and they're looking for just continuing that deep relationship, what would be maybe a message of hope and encouragement that you want to give to the couples?
Sure. Where we live in an area that is, the soil is very clay dense. And often when we've gone to the nursery, maybe to purchase a shrub or something, the person working at the nursery, their first question is often, do you need any amendments for your soil? Meaning, do you need something that you add to the soil so it's not so clay oriented, so clay dense? I think that's what something like what we've written, but also the work in marriage is meant to be. We need amendments to our soil, whether that's a writing, whether that's a podcast, whether that's a trusted friend, whether that's a life coach, whatever it might be. What are our amendments? For those listening, what are your amendments to your soil? That actually allow and invite it to grow, to nourish, to flourish. Sometimes those are just amendments, are just surface. Like, we have blueberry bushes and you put acid on the soil. That's an amendment. Sometimes it's not digging deep. Sometimes it's more surface oriented. It doesn't mean one is better or worse, but I think whatever your soil needs, that's part of the imagery we'll use and we did use in the writing, is sometimes it takes deep work. We uproot what is maybe not flourishing, and we attend to it with care. So I think inviting listeners to be aware of where they are in the journey and what does our soil need? It's a really courageous question to ask, I think, especially in the marriage journey that we're on.
That's so good. Well, where can our listeners and viewers go to get the book, and what other resources would you like to share with them?
Sure. All the resources that we have are through the website, our website called thereconnectinstitute.com. That's where we have, the book is there. The book's also on all book platforms. On the website, we have resources for couples that maybe, you know, want to do some intentional work together or attend one of our intensives. So that's the best resource for them.
That's great. Well, we will be sure to put all of that in our show notes. But Steve, this has been a great conversation. I mean, I could talk to you all day about this stuff because I really feel like you're a wealth of knowledge and wisdom in this. And so thanks for spending some time with us today.
Of course, Jonathan. Thanks for the invite. It was great to visit with you.
Yeah. Well, listeners and viewers, again, we're going to put all that info in the show notes and other resources that are going to help you to continue to move from brokenness to wholeness in Christ. And we want to help you take your next best step on that journey. So please reach out to us. And we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.
Pure Sex Radio is paid for by Be Broken Ministries. Visit us online at puresexradio.com.